The ultimate aim of Castaneda's guided adventures in the deserts, mountains, and towns of Mexico with his teachers was for him to encounter his double, his other self. According to Castaneda, all humans have another self, which exists all the time alongside the self we are normally aware of. Two selves exist because of our two-step process of perception. The other self is a more basic and more complete version of our being than our self of daily life. It needs the daily self to thrive and survive as a predator and to make sense of life. To have a life, basically. Having awareness of the two selves at the same time is being in touch with the totality of ourselves. Because of our two-step perception, we always exist as two beings, but we are normally only aware of one. In the act of perception, our core being initially perceives the world directly. We disregard that direct perception, then go a step further to impose our thoughts onto the energy we have just apprehended. The result of that extra step is the perception of our normal self in our world. We pay attention only to that secondary product of perception. There is a tiny instant of time between the original direct perception and the secondary one. We use that interval to deny and forget our primary perception and move our full attention to the secondary perception instead. But we still have a self that exists in that first world of perception, even though we deny and disregard it. Once we learn to do the two steps of perception, which we are taught from the moment of birth, our two selves operate separately. The new self, the self that lives in the agreed-on real world, automatically operates the process of perception throughout life. The world doesn't yield to us directly. The description of the world stands in between. So properly speaking, we are always one step removed, and our experience of the world is always a recollection of the experience. We are perennially recollecting the instant that has just happened, just passed. We recollect, recollect, recollect. We can talk about this process of perception and the double, and our words can make us feel we have some grasp of the topic, or at least a way to point towards it. But we can't apprehend the double through language. Talking and thinking about the double doesn't put us in touch with it. That's the flaw with words. They always make us feel enlightened, but when we turn around to face the world, they always fail us, and we always end up facing the world as we always have, without enlightenment. The other self can be encountered accidentally due to illness, insanity, love, war, or extreme shock. Or it can be encountered more harmoniously but still haphazardly in dreaming. In both cases, our typical reaction is to quickly revert to our world of thinking, which negates the memory of the double or interprets it as something else. Matus and Don Gennaro gradually taught Castaneda to encounter his other self, his double, by dreaming it. They went on to guide him to the realization that it's actually the double that dreams the self of normal awareness. This is the mystery of the dreamer and the dreamed. The dreamer and the dreamed live almost concurrently, separated by a minuscule interval of time. They experience the same events but perceive them differently. The dreamer's awareness is much more broad and inclusive, while also more disordered and unruly. The dreamer perceives eternity, but cannot speak about it or about anything. On the other hand, the awareness of the dreamed self is curtailed, blinkered, organized, and protected. The dreamer is aware of the dreamed, but the dreamed has been taught to disregard and deny the dreamer. The dreamer experiences everything immediately, while the dreamed self experiences everything after a time lag. During this microscopic time lag, he imposes his thoughts and images, making the raw data conform to his view of the world. The dream self collects a selection of perceived events during his life and plays them over and over in his mind. He calls this his memory. His personal history and identity are constructed from these selected memories. Most experience is forgotten, but still exist in hidden caches of denied and misunderstood imagery. The paradox of memory is that our memories of the normal self are mostly the denial of memory. To remember in a deeper sense is to remember the other self. We are taught from birth to focus our attention exclusively on the dreamed self that exists in our shared world into which we have been thrown. We share our world with other beings that are part of our era, our cohort. We have an agreement with them about what is real and what isn't real. According to Matus, to be real means to be agreed upon. This agreement is not self-chosen or arbitrary. It's imposed on us by the universe's intent for its own purposes, which we can't fathom. Our normal life consists mainly of the constant and engulfing effort to maintain, energize, explain, understand, and renew this agreed-on real world. Our deeds, thoughts, and words are engaged mainly in the act of asserting the realness of our world that we have been taught since day one. We are constantly in denial of the double, who is actually the dreamer that dreams us. In this activity, we are accomplishing magic and sorcery. We are denying what is basic and replacing it with a description, a story. The dream person has learned to disregard his other self and its doings. We also disregard our disregarding. We have learned various habitual ways of thinking and doing repetitive and compulsive activities to keep the other self out of awareness. We disregard those efforts, just as we disregard our autonomic body functions which control breathing, digestion, fear. To top it off, we are taught not only to ignore the other self, but also to deny it actively, supposedly to simplify our passage through life, to make life easier. Unless we are taught about it, we are never aware of our double during life until the moment of death. Just before death, when our energy fails and we can no longer perform the two-step process of perception, we lose awareness of our real self and revert to our double in whatever condition it may be after a lifetime of neglect. The memories stored then explode into awareness, and we relive them one by one. Our life passes before our eyes. To teach him about his double self, Don Juan and Don Gennaro continually move Castaneda from his normal self to his double. From the position of their luminous beings, they push the assemblage point on his luminous being. Castaneda experiences this usually as a slap on the back. They often struggle to return him to normal awareness. Sometimes they can bring him back with another slap on the back, but sometimes it requires throwing buckets of water on him. The two teachers also continually show Castaneda their own doubles without telling him what they are doing. The double is not an organism, like us, that must breathe and eat. Trying to teach while also amusing themselves, they tease and confuse him, daring him to realize he's in the presence of a double that doesn't need to perform normal bodily functions like defecating. The first day Castaneda met Don Gennaro, he met Don Gennaro's double, and it ended in the pretended trip to the bushes described earlier. Castaneda dutifully recorded it in his notes without getting the joke. A concept like the double can certainly be described as outlandish, even bizarre, but it's actually no weirder than some of the accepted precepts of modern physics. Quantum physics has a very strange concept called superposition, where an electron or other particle can be in two places at once. Superposition also weirdly resembles the double in that it's virtually impossible to observe. When you observe the double particles, the observation collapses and goes back to what is normally conceived, where the particle exists only in one place. According to Castaneda, the double does that too. You can be double, but only one at a time. The total luminous being, which contains both selves, the dreamer and the dreamed, has 8 points, which can be visualized. Don Juan drew a diagram in the dust, a geometrical shape with 8 points. The 8 points, organized from small to large, were called reason, talking, dreaming, seeing, feeling, will, the known, and the unknown. This diagram had 2 epicenters. The first epicenter was reason. Don Juan explained that reason dominates our era, even though it is by far the smallest point in the diagram, and it is out on the perimeter and connected to only one other point. Reason is the smallest point and the most isolated from our total being. We now are living in an age when reason is our epicenter. The only other point reason connects directly with is called talking. Talking refers to our ongoing internal and external dialogue by which we impose our thoughts and learned expectations on the raw data of perception. When reason connects with talking, we call that understanding. We use only the 2 smallest points in the totality of ourselves, reason and talking. Normally in our lives, we never even become aware of the remaining 6 points. Reason and talking comprise the normal self of our era in human history. Talking, though, is connected to 3 larger points: dreaming, seeing, and feeling. Our reason and talking have definitions for those 3 points, but very constricted definitions. These 3 concepts also have larger meanings. Dreaming is not simply something done while sleeping, but the movement of the assemblage point with its alignment of new strands of energy, whether done while asleep or awake. Seeing is the initial step of perception, before the interpretation step. It means seeing as opposed to looking. Feeling refers to the feeling of the double, which interacts with the world by projecting tentacles of energy strands outward. These 3 points, dreaming, seeing, and feeling, do not touch the point of reason. Reason cannot connect directly with these 3 points or anything beyond. These 3 points and all beyond are unreasonable. Still, reason is the dominant epicenter in our era. Although the smallest point in the human luminous being, reason is nevertheless something like the hero of modern humanity. Reason rescued us from earlier times when larger, darker powers dominated human life. Reason established its dominion by using language and talking to circumscribe and curtail the meanings of the concepts dreaming, seeing, and feeling. Dreaming, seeing, and feeling are concepts filled with vast powers and used to have greater importance in our earlier era of human history, when they were dominant and reason was hardly known at all. Dreaming, seeing, and feeling are connected to a much larger point, will. Will refers to the ability of the luminous being itself to act with intention in its own domain, where every being appears as a cocoon-like conglomeration of strings of energy that go to infinity. Will acts with its tentacles, its raw strings of aware energy. From a sorcery point of view and from ancient man's position, will was the predominant epicenter. Reason was then off to the side, despised and ignored. Will is the central point that organizes the being and the activities of the other self, the dreamer. The world upheld by will is the world of the other self. just as the world upheld by reason is the world of our normal self. The final two points are the known and the unknown. These points are much larger than the combined total of all the other points. In fact, to put the entire diagram in a more accurate perspective, if we imagined a football stadium, reason would be just the rule book in the referee's pocket, while the known would be the entire stadium, and the unknown would be the infinite world beyond the stadium. Tales of Power tells the story of Castaneda's final days with Don Juan Matus. By the end of the book, Matus and his group of old sorcerers have gone, and Castaneda has leaped off a cliff, along with the other two apprentices, Pablito and Nestor. To set up the depiction of these events, Castaneda explained the final two of the 8 points on the diagram that makes up the totality of man. He said that the life of a human being is composed of two sides, which Matus names the Tonal and the Nagual. These two words are said to come from ancient American folklore. It's hard to find exact English words to replace them. A rough translation of the Tonal is the known, and the Nagual is the unknown. The known is temporary, beginning at birth and ending at death. The unknown is always there, eternal. The unknown is aware of everything but cannot speak. The known can speak but has a limited controlled awareness. It can point in the general direction of the unknown if called upon to do so, but is normally not aware of the unknown's existence. The known goes a step further and actively denies the existence of the unknown. Matus says the Tonal's great art is to suppress any manifestation of the Nagual in such a manner that even if its presence should be the most obvious thing in the world, it is unnoticeable. We're always surrounded by eternity, but we're busy thinking of important things. The known is everything we know or think we know, and everything we have a word for during our lifetime. This includes ourselves as people, our identities, and all the things we identify as being in the world, including God, the soul, and the devil, and any concept we can think of. The known makes up its own rules by which it apprehends the world and therefore creates and sustains its world. Without the known, there would be no meaning, language, or order in our perceptions. There would only be indescribable chaos. The known of any sentient being is best visualized as a small island, suspended in a vast universe, which is almost completely composed of the unknown. The unknown can be visualized as an entire universe of power and awareness that acts constantly and knows and directs everything, but cannot say anything or understand who it is or what it is doing. The unknown is everything that exists apart from the tiny island of the known. The unknown is unimaginably immense. When Matus taught his apprentices about this topic, they carried a small table on a 4-hour hike into the desert. They found a valley and placed the table on the ground with kitchen utensils on top. Then they hiked for another 2 hours to the top of a nearby mountain and looked down at the table. He told them that the surface of the barely visible table represented the known, with the utensils being items of our understanding. Then he waved his arms around, saying that everything else was the unknown. The unknown can't be described in words. If something can be described, it's part of the known. The effects of the unknown can be witnessed, but not explained. You can only point towards it. Matus asserts that it's possible to enter the unknown and witness and even use its power. But while experiences in the unknown can and do happen, they can't necessarily be described or analyzed. Mostly they are not even remembered. Our identity, our personhood, is in the known part of ourselves. When the known becomes aware that it is speaking about itself, it invents words like I and myself. In the unknown, we have no identity. We have only power and effect. We are born, and for a short time after, we are all unknown. We are confronted by an operating world that we must learn to share and participate in. Our known begins to develop through a total monumental effort. We can't remember this effort because it happened before we developed our identity, memory, and language. The known's importance is so encompassing that eventually we become completely invested in it and forget what came before. We retain a vague sense of our other self, so we begin making pairs in our thinking. We think of mind and body, matter and energy, God and the devil. But these are singular concepts that are part of the known. They're all things that are known in some way, things that have words attached to them. They do not comprise the actual duality that our complete being is composed of, which is the known and the unknown. The unknown can surface in our lives, but only inadvertently. We can't consciously arrange to encounter it. However, the unknown can arise, and when it does, the known can become aware of the totality of oneself. Usually this only happens at the moment of death. In Tales of Power, Castaneda recounted how Matus taught him about the known and the unknown, and about how the known rules our lives even though it's weak in comparison to our other side, the unknown. Because of its weakness and vulnerability, the known must be cunning and ingenious in maintaining the illusion that the unknown doesn't exist. If the unknown does emerge, the known becomes vulnerable. Anything more than a brief glimpse of the unknown is deadly for the known, and therefore for the entire being. When the unknown emerges, it is like a bad dog. Repeatedly, Matus dumped buckets of water on Castaneda to whip his Nagual back to its place. The Tonal must be protected at any cost. The crown has to be taken away from it, but it must remain as the protected overseer. The unknown can only emerge safely if it's used to boost the known. When this is achieved, it's called personal power. Without long and careful training, any encounter with the unknown results in the known crapping out, creating a fatal shock. Without training, the known prefers to die rather than to give up control. Training the known consists of removing all unnecessary items from it, cleaning the island of the Tonal. Any habits, thoughts, beliefs, and especially memories of relationships that would prevent the known from surviving an encounter with the unknown must be uncovered and released. A new internal dialogue must be developed that allows for the awareness of both the known and the unknown. Tales of Power concludes with the pivotal act on which all of Castaneda's writings hinged. In 1973, Castaneda, together with Pablito and Nestor, followed Matus and his group of sorcerers to a high plateau in the mountains of Mexico. At the edge of the plateau was a sheer cliff. This particular plateau and cliff were part of the history and folklore of Matus's sorcery tradition. Throughout history, many sorcery groups and trained warriors had come there for their ultimate and final meeting together. At the end of their training, apprentices leaped from the cliff. Castaneda did the same at the end of Tales of Power. The events on the plateau marked the final appearance of Don Juan and Don Gennaro, who also leaped but didn't come back, and the end of Castaneda's apprenticeship. Of course, we know that the author survived to tell his story and many others in future books. Before the jump, Castaneda was given the sorcerer's explanation, which clarified how this act could be performed, how a person could leap off a cliff and survive. According to this explanation, when we are in the pure unknown, we are composed of a cluster of feelings, beings, and cells. that exist and float in the unknown, like barges, peaceful, unaltered, forever. Batuza's explanation continued. Then the glue of life binds some of them together. When the glue of life binds those feelings together, a being is created. A being that loses the sense of its true nature and becomes blinded by the glare and clamor of the area where beings hover, the tonal. The tonal is where all the unified organization exists. A being pops into the tonal once the force of life has bound all the needed feelings together. The tonal begins at birth and ends at death. As soon as the force of life leaves the body, all those single awarenesses disintegrate and go back again to where they came from, the Nagual. At death, they sink deeply and move independently as if they had never been a unit. There is a principle in physics which states that matter cannot be created or destroyed. In the same way, Castaneda's universe is made up of units of cells and feelings which are eternal. When the units are in the unknown, they float separately. To emerge into the known, they are collected into groups by the life force. When the being dies, the units separate again and return to float in the unknown. When Castaneda leapt off the cliff, he did it as a trained warrior who had practiced and been prepared to venture intentionally into the unknown. Entering the unknown in this way was like dying, except that the individual units only expanded without losing their togetherness. A trained warrior could then reintegrate his components in any form he knew at any location he chose. This pivotal moment of Castaneda's learning, the leap off the cliff, caused an unavoidable and final conflict between his reason and the totality of himself. Matus pointed out that the sorcerer's explanation seems harmless and charming, but it delivers a blow that no one can parry. Leaping from the cliff was not the conclusion of Castaneda's apprenticeship. It was the end of his time with his teachers, which had lasted 13 years. But much of his learning up to this point took place in the unknown, and he couldn't remember it in his normal awareness. The remaining task of remembering and integrating all he had been taught then began, which took another decade and more. Castaneda's struggle revealed the central paradox of perception. In the two-step process which comprises perception, where we are constantly recollecting, we have two separate sets of perceived data, but we choose to see and remember only one. As Castaneda said, "I was too lazy to remember what I had seen. Therefore, I only bothered with what I had looked at. It is hard to believe that I can remember now something I didn't remember at all a while ago." He concluded that all of us look and see at the same time, but we choose not to remember what we see. In the two-step process of perception, we always see first, but immediately ignore what we see to focus only on what we look at instead. This act of perception is the core of our being. As we grow up, we develop our attention. Attention is the ability to hold the images of the world. Once we can perceive the agreed world and hold it in place, our perception becomes a constantly repeating two-step process, which always produces the same being in the same world. The first step is the raw act of perception, in which the cocoon of aware energy interacts with other aware energy. The second step is our magical ability to set aside the primary perception and then impose the familiar images of our normal world onto what we are seeing. We always perceive the agreed-on images of our real world, the world we agree is real. We do this with others who've been taught the same. We all forcefully deny that any such thing would even be possible. When an assemblage point fixes itself in a position inside the cocoon and aligns the energy that goes through it, the result is a dream. We are all dreamers dreaming together. This is the basic act for all sentient beings, this act of magic. Every species and sort of being does the same. We are born perceivers, inserted into being at one particular place, but capable of perceiving many worlds. We learn to perceive one world exclusively, intensively, and as completely as possible. To hold the images of the one agreed-on world, we think about it and talk about it over and over, broadening and deepening our understanding of our projected world, and call that intelligence. The exclusive awareness of the ordinary world is first achieved in childhood, not long after birth. We keep our focus steady throughout life by constant effort. We are normally unaware of this effort that keeps our world assembled, just as we are unaware of the autonomic nervous system that keeps our body breathing and functioning. We engage and entangle ourselves with the agreed-on world through language, images, and symbols. With these, we produce a constant stream of interior and exterior dialogue, through which we maintain and continually refresh our awareness of our world. This conscious and subconscious maintenance of our attention monopolizes our energy, leaving nothing left. Another way to describe this process is to say there are two types of attention. The first attention is our awareness of the agreed-on real world. At birth, we didn't have this attention. It had to be developed. We learned very early in life how to hold on to the images of the agreed-on real world, and once engaged with it, we were taught to never question it. We hooked ourselves into the ring of power that engaged us fully with that world. All our energy and complete sense of self were assigned to that ring of power. The first attention is paying attention to the known. The second attention is the attention of the unknown, which we keep out of awareness. Just before the moment of death, the loss of life energy causes the two-step process of perception to stop. The second attention emerges then, along with all the hidden memories contained in it, and an inexplicable universe is revealed. There is a way to reach the second attention during life by utilizing the three intermediary processes of the 8-point diagram: dreaming, seeing, and feeling. Just as there were no standard steps for reaching the first attention in childhood, there are also none for the second attention. It must be done with a total effort, born of a clear and persistent intention to get there. It needs to be a matter of life and death, which is why Matus set it up for the apprentices to kill Castaneda. Without the impetus of a life or death situation, humans won't reach the second attention. The full and final version of the mastery of awareness was gradually developed in the fire from within. Then in the introduction to The Power of Silence, Castaneda formally summarized, "The mastery of awareness, which was the cornerstone of his teachings and which consists of the following basic premises. 1. The universe is an infinite agglomeration of energy fields, resembling threads of light. 2. These energy fields, called the eagle's emanations, radiate from a source of inconceivable proportions, metaphorically called the eagle. 3. Human beings are also composed of an incalculable number of the same thread-like energy fields. These eagle emanations form an encased agglomeration that manifests itself as a ball of light the size of the person's body, with the arms extended laterally, like a giant luminous egg. 4. Only a very small group of the energy fields inside this luminous ball are lit up by a point of intense brilliance located on the ball's surface. 5. Perception occurs when the energy fields in that small group immediately surrounding the point of brilliance extend their light to illuminate identical energy fields outside the ball. Since the only energy fields perceivable are those lit by the point of brilliance, that point is named the point where perception is assembled, or simply, the assemblage point. 6. The assemblage point can be moved from its usual position on the surface of the luminous ball to another position on the surface or into the interior. Since the brilliance of the assemblage point can light up whatever energy field it comes in contact with, when it moves to a new position, it immediately brightens up new energy fields, making them perceivable. This perception is known as seeing. 7. When the assemblage point shifts, it makes possible the perception of an entirely different world, as objective and factual as the one we normally perceive. Sorcerers go into that other world to get energy, power, solutions to general and particular problems, or to face the unimaginable. 8. Intent is the pervasive force that causes us to perceive. We do not become aware because we perceive. Rather, we perceive as a result of the pressure and intrusion of intent. 9. The aim of sorcerers is to reach a state of total awareness in order to experience all the possibilities of perception available to man. This state of awareness even implies an alternative way of dying. The force or energy in the aware filaments, which are the basic elements of the universe, is incomprehensible to us. The closest we can come to understanding that energy is to see it as the universe's intent. Somehow, it expresses the intent of the universe. Those filaments can also be called the universe's commands. They command us to be and command us to perceive. In fact, they command everything, everywhere. The universe's intent forces us to perceive. Our entire existence and being is determined by the commands of its strings of energy, which express its intent. The universe's intent creates the cocoon and fills it with energy, and then puts the assemblage point in its place on the surface of that cocoon, commanding the being to perceive at that position. The perceiver learns to hold the assemblage point firmly and steadily at that point and prevent it from moving. The resulting alignment produces a being living in a world. That being develops his or her own intent and identity, which pursues its own objectives and forgets where it came from and for what purpose, and even that it is connected to the universe's intent. During dreaming, the assemblage point dislodges itself from its fixed position and moves around. The person dreaming cannot control where the assemblage point initially moves. He or she can intend to align the energy encountered at any new position and hold it steady in that new place. If this new place is far enough from the previous place, the magic of perception will align a new world and a new perceiver simultaneously. A being will pop into existence in another world. From our perspective, it's impossible to say where that other world is. It might be infinity, or on the other side of the universe, or right next to us, but in another dimension. It really can only correctly be said to be at that position of the assemblage point. The universe has untold billions of positions where assemblage points can assemble strands of aware energy. At any position where a particular selection of countless energy strands is assembled is where that world is, and that being, and that event. To return to that world and that event, it is necessary to return to that precise position of the assemblage point. From the dreamer's point of view, he has traveled to another world, somewhere out there in infinity, through his connection with the universe, which is his assemblage point, by aligning new strings of energy which stretch out to infinity. The dreamer's departure point was also a place somewhere in infinity, and must be returned to by finding the exact position of the assemblage point where our normal world exists. The experiences encountered at the new position of the assemblage point are stored there. Memories and information are stored at very precise positions of the assemblage point. Once put in storage, the dreamer can later return to that point and relive that experience exactly as it happened before and have access to the knowledge there with greater clarity and intensity than was originally. When a dreamer begins to explore new worlds by reaching new positions of the assemblage point, he gets on a path which is familiar to other experienced dreamers. There are milestones on the early parts of that path that all dreamers necessarily pass through. There are several proximal positions that he will encounter early in his ventures. One of these initial destinations is the position of the mold of man. The mold of man is an entity, neither male nor female, which shapes the force of life into human form. Every form of life has a mold, which exists at a position of the assemblage point near to the one normally used. The mold of a man can be encountered when the assemblage point shifts, either in dreaming or due to illness, shock, or another occasion when we have sufficient power. Always see it at the moment of death, when our life energy is gone and we can no longer hold our assemblage point still and control our perception. It appears as a radiant, luminous being. According to Matus, the mold of man is a cluster of emanations in the band of every man and woman. It is the portion of the ego's emanations that seers can see directly without any danger to themselves. The mold was seen by the ancient sorcerers and has been seen by many mystics throughout human history. According to Matus, the ancient sorcerers mistook it as a protector or friendly spirit that could grant favors, protection, or powers. Mystics saw the mold of man and misinterpreted it as being our God. If we are in its presence, our self-centeredness makes us project our most cherished characteristics onto it. Love, forgiveness, charisma, understanding, justice, truth. In comparison to this projection, we feel ourselves as unworthy, villainous, sinful, and evil. The mystical experience wherein one encounters the mold of man is a chance seeing caused by a random movement of the assemblage point. It's a one-shot affair, after which the mystic remembers the vision and feelings of awe and reverence and assumes that he was in the presence of humanity's God. One short vision of this sort can result in a lifetime of nostalgia. The new seers made a point of seeing the mold many times. By seeing it repeatedly, they determined that it is not a god. The mold has no power to do anything other than stamp us out as humans. It can't reward or punish us or intervene on our behalf in any way. It is simply a pattern of energy that stamps human qualities onto aware energy, like a dye that reproduces human beings. but we are not created from nothing by it, and it can't favor or help us in any way. To free their assemblage points for further exploration, the new seers intentionally viewed the mold many times to see it for what it really is. As part of that process of liberation, the force the mold normally leaves in the body, called the human form, is scared off and detaches itself. After the human form is gone, the seer can look at himself and his perceptions with more emotional detachment, which enhances his freedom. When the intent of the energy inside the cocoon aligns itself with the energy from outside, it is briefly aligned with universal intent. Through repetition, the intent inside the cocoon becomes familiar with the universe's intent, so the universe's intent can become our intent. When a person's intent merges with universal intent or command, his or her assemblage point can then go to somewhere they intend. Matu says, "Our command becomes the eagle's command." During his or her life, a sorcerer, defined as one who can move his assemblage point with his intent, can gradually move it around within his cocoon to eventually contact and light up all the energy inside the cocoon that is in man's band. Once this is accomplished, the entire cocoon is lit up from within in a flash and becomes like a huge conductor of channeled energy. The being enters the third attention, which is an alternative way of dying. This is called burning with the fire from within. In our current monotheistic religions, there is one way of dying with two paths after death. A person dies and then is judged by God, and either goes to heaven or hell for eternity. In Castaneda's theology, there is no God to teach and judge us. There is no heaven or hell or evil. According to Castaneda, it's possible to die in two ways, and it's also possible to extend existence in several ways. One can die in the first attention, where the elements that have been gathered by the force of life simply separate and float off into the unknown, as if they had never been together. Alternatively, after a lifetime exploring the second attention, one can go into the third attention by burning from within. Don Juan said he was sure that thousands of seers accomplished this and entered on a definitive journey, keeping their life force with infinity as their new realm. He believed that their awareness would last as long as the earth existed, and they would die when the earth died. An even larger number of sorcerers, though, including almost all the ancient sorcerers of Mexico, also did not die, according to Matus. Instead, while trying to navigate through the second attention, they stumbled into realms that are arguably worse than death. Due to misguided efforts to prolong their lives, most of them ended up lost, kidnapped, or imprisoned somewhere in infinity. To venture in the unknown is a challenge for humans, and Castaneda said the purpose of life is to enrich awareness by including parts of the unknown into the area of the known. This brings us close to the universe's intention to know itself. New types of perception also bring new energy. Matu said that his system provided the best answer to the question that has always haunted man: the reason for our existence. Our rationality cannot come up with an answer to this without involving a blind leap of faith. According to Matus, the universe actively bestows awareness upon sentient beings so that the sentient beings can enhance the awareness during the process of life and then return the awareness to the universe in an enhanced condition. The reason for existence is to enhance awareness on behalf of the universe. Matus said this is a fact that can be witnessed, not just a belief. The traditional Mexican sorcery way to interpret this is to glimpse the eagle. A projected image of the bestower of awareness that gives awareness to beings at birth and then eats the enhanced awareness when the being dies. A universal force loans a primal awareness to sentient beings. It continually attracts that awareness back towards itself, while the awareness is being enriched and enhanced during life. The living being resists this attraction during life until it is exhausted, and the universal force disintegrates the living being and recovers the awareness again, enhanced by that lifetime's experiences. At the moment of death, all of life's experiences are released from where they were stored as the universe claims the awareness as its food. Matthus doesn't credit Darwin's theory of evolution. He would say that species don't evolve because accidental mutations happen that prove to be advantageous and then become permanent changes. Individual beings change during their lifetimes as they enhance their awareness. A change in awareness is a change of the position of the assemblage point, which implies a change of being. Species-wide evolutionary changes are a matter of the entire species intentionally choosing a new position of the assemblage point after individuals point the way.